You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series.
What Might Be and Ought to Be, The Idealism of Objectivism by Aaron Smith.
The subject of today's session is idealism, or I would put it as moral idealism, especially as projected in Ayn Rand's novel, The Fountainhead. Now, I'm not going to assume that you've read the novel, though I imagine most or maybe many of you have. And I want to begin with what I take to be a philosophically neutral definition of idealism. It's kind of hard to find, but I use the venerable dictionary.com because, well, you know, that's where I found the most neutral one. Just so we know, in essence, what we're talking about. And they define it as the cherishing or pursuit of high or noble principles, purposes, goals, etc. So the cherishing or pursuit of high or noble principles, goals, purposes. And that's good enough for a working definition. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to begin by framing the discussion and getting some material out on the table, and then I'll open it up for discussion. And I want to start with a few words on The Fountainhead and the appeal that it has had. So I'll tell you a little bit of a story. By 1941, Ayn Rand had submitted The Fountainhead to 12 different publishers, all of whom had rejected the book, saying it was too controversial, it was too intellectual, that there wasn't an audience for the book, and that the book wouldn't sell. Now, Rand eventually found a publisher after an editor at Bob's Merrill, Archibald Ogden, staked his job on the book. And as a result, The Fountainhead was published in 1943. In 1968, 25 years later, despite all the gloomy predictions about its fate, sales of The Fountainhead had far exceeded anyone's expectations, and it had been listed in numerous bestseller lists, and it had remained in print for 25 years. That's a major achievement, and we're at another milestone this year. So, as many of you may know, this is the 75th anniversary of the publication of The Fountainhead. So, go Fountainhead. And in that year, in 1968, Ayn Rand was asked to write an introduction for the 25th anniversary edition of the novel, in which she took the opportunity to reflect on the novel and on its continuing appeal. And in that introduction, she emphasized several points that are relevant to the topic of idealism. She identified the school of literature to which her novels and her writing belong as Romanticism, a school of literature that, quote, deals not with the random trivia of the day, but with the timeless, fundamental, universal problems and values of human existence. It does not record or photograph, it creates and projects. It is concerned, in the words of Aristotle, not with things as they are, but with things as they might be and ought to be. And quoting from her talk called The Goal of My Writing, she says, "This is the motive and purpose of my writing, the projection of an ideal man, the projection of a moral ideal as my ultimate literary goal, as an end in itself." And that's certainly what The Fountainhead offers, a moral ideal. And she held that a moral ideal is a real need for people, particularly the young. She writes, quote, "The best of mankind's youth start out life with a sense of enormous expectation, a sense that one's life is important, that great achievements are within one's capacity, and that great things lie ahead." And that, quote, "Whatever their future, at the dawn of their lives, men seek a noble vision of man's nature and of life's potential." And for anyone looking for a noble vision of man's nature, she says there are very few guideposts to find. The Fountainhead is one of them. And she says this is one of the cardinal reasons for The Fountainhead's lasting appeal. It is a confirmation of youth, proclaiming man's glory, showing how much is possible. Now, I don't know about you, but this was certainly the case for me. So I grew up in a small rural town with nothing inspiring in it. There was a Rubbermaid plant, a mall, a small college, and the great tire fire of 1983, which started in a dump outside the town and burned for nine months. I was very independent-minded, and I hated conformity of any kind. But by the time I went to college, all I knew was that I wanted to study something I enjoyed, and I wanted to get the hell out of that town. Then in my first year of college, on the recommendation of a friend of my brother's who I didn't like, I read The Fountainhead. And what it gave me was exactly what Rand said, a noble vision of man's nature and of life's potential. And that changed my life. After I read The Fountainhead, I read Atlas Shrugged immediately, and then soon after quit college. I realized I had no idea what I was doing with my life, no real conception of what a career looks like or what it means to take your life seriously. I had to take time to process what I was being given. So I went back to, well, I used to be a gymnastics coach. I went back to for doing that a couple of years, read everything by Ayn Rand, trying to figure out like what it is I want to do with my life now that I have a sense of what it means to really take your life seriously. I decided on philosophy and the rest is history. But I think I'm by no means unique in this regard. I've heard many variations of this kind of story from people. And you may have your own. And I think it's because each of us has to face, in some form or other, two philosophical questions that lie at the heart of ethics. And the first is, what kind of a person do I want to be? And the second, what kind of a life do I want to live? And when we're young, we don't really know what's possible, and we don't really know where to look to find a model. And if you simply look around you, you may not find much of anything to inspire you. Or you'll find bits and pieces of admirable traits in various people blended together with shortcomings and disappointments and telephone calls. But rarely, if ever, do you see the embodiment of an ideal and have the opportunity to witness how such a person would live his life, face challenges, form relationships, deal with adversity. And this is where art, and I think particularly literature, can play a crucial role. Because it can show you the life and character of a moral individual in the kind of richly crafted detail that only literature can provide. Of course, not all art, and certainly not all literature does this or even aims to do it, but Rand's novels certainly do. And this is one of the major reasons why so many people find her books inspiring. Not just that she's presenting a moral ideal, but what that ideal looks like and what it feels like to contemplate and admire such a person. So part of the importance of having a moral ideal is that it gives one a goal or a target to aim at, a sense of what the complete product or the end product looks like. And Rand presented her first complete portrait of a moral ideal in the character of Howard Rourke in The Fountainhead. Now, without giving away the novel for those of you who haven't read it, I want to focus on three characteristics which Rourke embodies and which Rand held to be the essence of an ideal man: rationality, independence, and self-esteem. Let's take rationality. In his actions and choices, this character, Howard Rourke, in his thinking and in his valuing, Rourke is guided exclusively by reason, by his commitment to understand, to grasp the facts, to know. As a result, the ideas he accepts are convictions, not simply beliefs, not ideas adopted without understanding or accepted on faith. Of course, he experiences emotions. He's not Spock. Even intense emotions, because his emotions stem from these convictions. For example, the joy and satisfaction he gets in building. He's an architect, if you're unfamiliar with it. Or the feelings he has for the woman he loves. But he never allows his feelings or other people's opinions to be the determiner of his actions, because he knows that they cannot substitute for his own mind's understanding of the facts. A rational mind is guided by its clearest understanding of reality, not by feelings, hopes, fears, or wishful thinking. Independence. Take the second one. Rourke is independent in every fundamental sense, in his thinking, in his motivation, in his choice of values, and in his creative work. It is this fundamental orientation, this fundamental way of using his mind, this fundamental way in which he faces the world firsthand, not through others as a proxy or as a substitute, that really sets him apart. And in the novel, independence is really his kind of defining characteristic. He understands and accepts the responsibility of thinking for himself, of forming his own convictions, of deciding on the values that he'll pursue, and of accepting the responsibility for his own life. His thoughts are his own firsthand conclusions, and he recognizes no authority above the judgment of his own above his own independent judgment. He does not look for others to tell him what to think. Of course, he learns from others, but he understands that learning is an independent process of thought that each has to perform alone. And the standard by which he accepts something as true is his own grasp of the facts, to the best of his understanding. In terms of his career, he chooses the profession of architecture because he loves building. When he's asked by another character why he decided to become an architect, he responds, quote, "Because I love this earth. That's all that I love. I don't like the shape of things on this earth, and I want to change them." He sees no advantage in compromising his values or convictions, and he does not himself permit any breach between his convictions and his actions. It's the virtue of integrity. As he explains to the dean of the architecture school where he was a student, Rourke says, quote, "I have, let's say, 60 years to live. Most of that time will be spent working. I've chosen the work I want to do. If I find no joy in it, then I'm condemning myself to 60 years of torture." Think about that. And I can find the joy only if I do my work in the best way possible to me. But the best is a matter of standards, and I set my own standards. I remember reading that passage for the first time, thinking about that, about a career. 60 years of torture. It makes sense. And there's a scene in the book in which Rourke refuses to accept an important contract at a moment when he desperately needs it. He refuses in order to maintain the integrity of his architectural design and of his integrity as a designer. And when he refuses, someone tells him, "You need the commission. Do you have to be quite so fanatical and selfless about it?" And Rourke says, "What? It's a fanatical and selfless." Rourke smiled. He looked down at his drawings. His elbow moved a little, pressing them closer to his body. And he said, "That was the most selfish thing you've ever seen a man do." So Rourke's work and his convictions are too personally, selfishly important to him to betray. It's a matter of his own integrity and self-esteem to keep them intact. So let's take the third one, self-esteem. Just as his convictions and artistic standards are his own firsthand judgments, so is his estimate of himself. He judges himself based on his own record of achievement and on the character he has developed, not on other people's opinions or expectations, nor by establishing his worth by comparison to others. Because he always accepts the responsibility to think for himself and to think rationally, and because he chooses and pursues his own values and puts in the effort to accomplish them, he sees himself as both capable of achieving his values and worthy of the happiness that results from it, as both able and deserving of the result. Now the novel, this is a very brief sketch, and the novel provides you obviously with far more substance on any of these kinds of things than I can possibly give. But let me at least indicate why Rand thinks that the moral ideal she's created in the character of Rourke represents an ideal that's practical. And that was my problem with trying to find a definition. Most of the definitions you find in the dictionary say idealism, the concern with high and noble goals, often associated with youth and with hopeless quests and the impossible and the unattainable. And a lot of that has to do with, this is my water break. A lot of that has to do with the kinds of ideals people are offered and the kinds of standards that are set for what is ideal. Ayn Rand struggled with the issue of ideals throughout her whole life, of herself trying to define and fight for the ideal when others are not interested. They reject it, they don't want it, and life is difficult. And so one of the things she wanted to do, oh, and if you read her early fiction, some of it's pretty bleak. If you've read the play Ideal, I mean, the whole play is about the various ways in which people who profess a real loyalty and dedication to their ideals betray them. It's a sad play. But so she struggled with this personally. And one of the things that she wanted to do in The Fountainhead was to show that the ideal is not just moral, but it's possible. So let me say a few things about why the characteristics I mentioned, the rationality, independence, and self-esteem, there's more that goes into it, but why those things she regards as practical. Rand's view is that if one is rational, one's thinking and actions are determined by one's best understanding of the facts. And this attitude is what keeps him in touch with the world with which he deals, rather than allowing his thinking to be determined or guided by his feelings, wishful thinking, conformity to other people's expectations. All of these practices consist in placing other considerations above reality, but there's nothing above reality. Reality is a set of facts that you have to deal with. And that's not a recipe for success. And this commitment to a reality-oriented mindset leads one to a clearer understanding of the world, of what one values, and of how to achieve one's values. Now, of course, this doesn't mean you're omniscient or infallible. One can always make mistakes or be fooled in various respects. But in general, one will have adopted the way of using one's mind and facing reality that does, in fact, lead to success. It leads to successful thinking and acting, and one's successes will augment one's sense of efficacy, resulting in an overall sense of self-confidence. If a person is independent in his thinking, in his valuing, in his work, he will not permit others to dictate his ideas or values or standards to him. He'll refuse to be anyone's slave or lackey. On intellectual, moral, and creative matters, an independent man does not obey. He may agree with knowledge that others have discovered, and he may accept that knowledge, but only to the extent that he himself actually understands its truth. And in this way, the values and convictions that form his character are deeply his own. They're part of him, and they're things that he does not betray. The alternative in that regard is to let others think for you, to populate your mind with borrowed opinions, values, ideas, goals, to which you have no real personal connection, that they're things that one adopts simply because, you know, you have to have some kind of ideas and goals if you're going to hang around. But in such a case, one doesn't really know or is taking the time to figure out whether these things are true or not, or worthwhile. And there's a character in the novel, a guy named Peter Keating, which it really embodies this. In this sense, he doesn't really have a self, I think, to the extent that he doesn't have values that are formed firsthand, or things that are important to him, convictions that he's formed because he's looked at reality and decided what is true. And part of the novel is trying to flesh out what that person's life looks like versus what Howard Rourke's life looks like. That goes to the issue of practicality. Self-esteem is the reward of a person's virtues. The value of self-esteem, I think, is impossible to exaggerate. It's the fundamental judgment that you pass on yourself. Are you capable of happiness? Are you worthy of it? It's very hard to proceed at all in life if your view of yourself is, I'm not good. That's one of the, well, I'll talk about self-esteem in another class, but that is one of the most paralyzing things that a person can experience. But self-esteem has to be earned. I'll tell a little story for the benefit of the people who don't attend the self-esteem thing. I said I used to be a gymnastics coach, and we were teaching some preschool classes. Well, they're preschool and up to about 6 years old. And upstairs in the preschool gym, which was a two-level place, they had this big painting, which I couldn't stand. It said, I don't know if you know anything about child raising, it said, I am great. I don't know. It was supposed to embody some kind of, you know, positive sense for, you know, for the kids and, you know, good job, you know. And it really embodied the way in which it was taught. Everything you did was great job and stuff like that. And I was just so irritated at this. I asked them if I could change the painting. So the way I taught my classes, I was very demanding of the kids. I mean, you know, for their level. That's not right. And just do it again. Do it again. No, go back, you know. And after a while, they're frustrated, and then they do it. And then you tell them. There you go. And they're like, oh, so, you know. So, you know, you don't inflate your currency in that regard. And I think that the kids, I mean, this is, you know, sports. This is a limited example. But particularly when kids are young, they get the experience that there are challenging things. They're hard. I fail and fail, and then I get it. Rinse and repeat. You know, you do that again and again, and after a while, you start to get the feeling like, yeah, I got this. And you might find, well, you reach your limit at a certain point when it comes to sports or certain kinds of things like that. But the idea is you get the conviction, yeah, there are challenging things ahead, and I've had these in the past and struggled hard on them, and eventually, you know, I succeeded and so on. So I changed the painting, and I had three big paintings of kids actually doing something in gymnastics. And it said, I can do it. And they're struggling with sweat, you know, coming out. I'm not a good artist, but at least it fulfilled my philosophical worries. So one who has earned self-esteem, in other words, the estimate that you have of yourself, and you've earned it, will approach life from the perspective that one's own life is worth living and worthy of being preserved. And I think that is valuable at every level and virtually at every moment. One doesn't usually spend one's day thinking about one's fundamental worthiness, but that's not really the way in which it shows up. It usually shows up at little chinks and lacks of self-confidence, little bits at work or in a relationship where you kind of compromise or you're just avoiding things sometimes and you're not always trying to seek the best for yourself. And that's the way in which that often shows up. I guess partly because that fundamental estimate of yourself is always with you. And it's always there and you're always making it, whether you think you're doing that or not. But one of the real values of self-esteem is that to the extent that one has self-esteem, one refuses to compromise one's happiness or to subordinate it to other concerns. And there are a lot of other competing concerns for your life and your time. And to the extent that one has self-esteem, you'll refuse to give up or surrender the unique value that is your life, or to accept the best, or accept less than the best possible to you. And Rand thinks there's nothing more practical than that. So when it comes to the answer to the question of whether idealism is practical, it depends on what you're trying to practice and what one's ideal is. If your conception of a moral ideal, for example, is God as the ideal, then yes, your ideal is impractical, since it's impossible to achieve or to live up to. And one must contend with the feeling that one is perpetually imperfect and unworthy. If one's ideal is opposed to what life and happiness requires, if, for example, it's a life of self-abnegation and self-sacrifice, as some secular moralists as well as religious urge, then yeah, the ideal is impractical if what you want to practice is living. If one's ideal fundamentally rests on and depends on others, their opinion, their esteem, their choices, then yes, I think that ideal is impractical and will lead to frustration and failure. You can think of, world peace or something like that. You think of people throwing themselves into some kind of cause. Not that that's not a good goal, but for Rand, a rational moral ideal is not something beyond this world or beyond the grave. It doesn't consist in the unachievable or the impossible or martyrdom to lost causes, but in a life and moral character that are achievable here on earth. Rational idealism consists in the commitment to achieve one's highest potential and to live up to it and never sacrifice it. And the ideal she presents is both a practical means to and the full realization of man at his highest possibility. So thank you. So that's by way of getting, I think, enough material on the table for a discussion. So I don't know whether the recording requires the questioners to come to the top, but I'd like this to be. Do you need the mic? Do I need to be by the mic? I do. I'm stuck here. It's not my stuff. Okay. It's gin. This is more my style. Okay, so you know what I was going to do? I almost started, my idea for the talk was, I asked myself the question, maybe it's kind of a weird question, but I asked myself, am I an idealist? And I found it surprisingly hard to answer. I thought it was, I assumed that it would be a simple question. Yeah, sure, whatever. And in thinking about that, it's like, well, what does it really mean to be an idealist? And am I one? I guess. Right? It's an odd thing. And I remember, I think Leonard Peikoff once said, and this maybe was anecdotal, that, and if you've read The Fountainhead, you know the character of Dominique Franken. And in his, this is Peikoff, but it's a paraphrase, but he said, Rand could understand why people didn't quite get Winand, or there's some characters they didn't get. She was baffled when people didn't get Dominique. And usually Dominique's the hardest one to get, I think. She says, if you don't understand Dominique, you don't understand idealism. And probably you don't understand me, you know, from her perspective. But I always thought that was interesting. But when I ask myself, am I an idealist? I think that's a hard question to answer. Do I take moral values seriously? Yes. It's one thing to have a sort of a vision of, like, this is what life can be like and this is what I want to be like. It's a very different thing to think, to what extent am I in practice devoted to achieving that in my own life and keeping that in front of me as like an active, this is what I'm doing and I'm really full on committed and this is what I'm doing in my life daily. I think that's very hard. And this is one of the things that annoys me about the idea that, happiness, well, what kind of moral goal is that? Happiness is hard. It's very hard. And there are all sorts of ways in your life, there are all sorts of things that put pressure on you in various kinds of ways that, and you don't usually think about yourself as doing this, but you compromise lots and lots of times. Or I say you, listen to me. I'm projecting. Little bits and pieces of things in life, just because life is stressful. There's a lot going on. There's relationships and difficulties and things, that all these kind of things where sometimes you're just trying to get by. And sometimes you realize you've been getting by and things like that. So I think the whole issue of idealism, it's not like, yeah, I'm an idealist because I'm an objectivist. If you really respond to the kind of ideal that Rand is presenting, like Rourke, and you say, yeah, this is admirable, this is amazing, and you just have this really powerful response to that, and many people do. But what does it really look like in practice to think that I'm doing in effect what Rourke is doing? Or what Dominique would do if she had a better view of the possibility of ideals in this world. Yeah.
Most psychologists believe that happiness is not the norm, that striving is the norm. And that happiness comes in, thank you, and that happiness comes in pieces. And that is really the rational way to look at it, because happiness is connected to achievement more times than not. For people with problems with depression and things like that, it comes in small victories, and that's what gives them happiness. So really, the norm is not happiness in life. Yeah. The norm is strife. And working to find out who you are, what you are, how you fit, what makes you happy in your endeavors in life. So happiness is not really the thing that we should expect to have all the time.
Oh no, and I think Ayn Rand would definitely think that happiness is a very difficult achievement, and I think she'd also think that not many people achieve it.
Correct.
And if you actually look up how she characterizes what happiness is, say like an Atlas Shrugged or something, that's a high bar. That's a very high bar. It is very difficult to achieve happiness. Yeah, and the idea that it is connected with achievement. And it doesn't always mean that, you know, you invent a new metal or you're some kind of a genius or something. But it's that, I mean, there's all forms of achievement.
And it's a journey. It's more a journey. Your life is a journey.
Yeah, and I the way...
Anything
yeah.
That, and that can contribute to that, you know, those times of happiness or joy or euphoria, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I, the way I think about it, about this, it's the end result versus the journey. I mean, I think there's, I mean, it's not that, I don't look at it as you go 50 years and then you hit happiness. And then you're like, I'm done. Mic down. It isn't really like that. That I think that the thing about it on a path is it's kind of like life in a way, is that life is in the living. And it's not that you get to the end and there's and then you're living. Though getting yourself to the position where you really are on the right track in your thinking and your approach to, you know, your life or your job or your relationships and things like that, that you can just say, yeah, I got this. You know, whatever. I mean, I have difficulties that come up and stuff, but I'm on the right track in the way I think about things, and I'm capable of handling what life throws at me. I mean, you barring some really horrible tragedies, but yeah, right.
I've got a quote here from We the Living, which I think speaks to this. So this is a conversation between Kira and Andre. So Kira asks, Andre, have you ever been happy? I've never been unhappy. Is that enough? Well, I always know what I want. And when you know what you want, you go toward it. Sometimes you go very fast, and sometimes only an inch a year. Perhaps you feel happier when you go fast. I don't know. I've forgotten the difference long ago, because it really doesn't matter so long as you move.
Yeah, and that's one of the, but the thing is, I like that, and thank you for this, a quote from We the Living, another of Ayn Rand's novels. The way I think about that too is that it's hard to sustain that. And, you know, I mean, this is recording. I feel like I've been running on fumes for a while. And I think it's, you know, and so when I'm writing this talk on idealism, I'm kind of thinking a lot about, like, what I'm doing kind of in my life. And I think one of the good things about Rand's novels is when I went to go look up a quote, I start reading in the middle of page 45, and next thing I know, I'm on page 95, you know, and feeling a lot better about life and, you know. This is one of the reasons also people go back to Rand's novels, like, again and again, to get in that world and to kind of experience that kind of fuel. Because, as she said, you know, you can run dry, and you need that kind of inspiration. And so I made the point that she's presenting a moral ideal, but she didn't. I think the way she put it is that my main purpose in literature is just to show, and so that you can have an experience of that and to just confront it. It's not really to, like, give you some sort of didactic lesson. But yeah, Scott.
I think along these lines, I wanted to get your thoughts a little bit more in depth on Peter Keating as a character, because I was talking with someone recently and we were talking about Keating versus Rourke, and how a lot of objectivists I know talk about objectivism when they're talking about Keating as strictly a villain or strictly focusing on the second-handed aspect of his character. And I always saw Keating as someone, and I think Rand talked about this, as someone that the reader is supposed to sort of relate to and find in himself as a reader to some extent. So that they can see the contrast more clearly with Rourke. So to me, it shouldn't be so obvious to the objectivist who's trying to live by the philosophy that Keating is so bad. It's a tragedy, in a sense, I've always thought, that Keating's life ends up the way it is. It's not like he's this horrible, evil person completely. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I'll say a couple of things about... So Peter Keating is for the... Is anyone unfamiliar with The Fountainhead? And don't... It's not a crime. Just, okay, it is a crime, but... The character of Peter Keating... So he's a mix, I think. Like, on the one hand, there's definitely a tragic aspect to him. but it's one he has to own. So I mean, when you think about like what's the good side of Keating, they're his first-hand values. So he had an early love for painting, or at least an early interest in painting, which his mom tried to help him kind of tried to divert into architecture, which is much more prestigious, and trying to nudge the kid into a career that made her feel better in some way, or less empty. But he went along with it, and he didn't really have the courage or the conviction or the strength of mind or whatever it would be. I don't know. I don't think say how old he was at the time. And his love for Catherine Halsey, the character, who's also tragic. But I think presented much more of a victim and less of playing an active role in shaping her, the way she turns out. And the way Keating ends up, of course, is really tragic, I think. And it's, yeah. And people ask sometimes, can Keating get better at this point? Can he kind of recover his life in some way? And maybe, but I think it's doubtful. And that's tragic, the unrecoverable, you know. But in many respects, it comes down to free will. I mean, it's like he makes the choices that he makes, and he's got to sleep in that bed, you know. And also, he does some things that are really bad, you know. I mean, so it's not so much like Katie Halsey, who just, you know, she is definitely more tragic. But he, you know, he tries to undermine Rourke in various kinds of ways. You know, he almost gets somebody to, well, I guess he kind of induces somebody, I think not exactly deliberately, but to have a heart attack. He undermines some people at the office to climb the ladder. I mean, he does some really bad things. And then every once in a while, his slightly better self or more honest or genuine self sort of steps out, usually when he's around Rourke. And he gets that little window opens up just a little bit, you know, when he appreciates something that Rourke says. Oh, this one isn't as crappy as all the rest of your drawings. And he's like, oh, yeah. it's like that feels better to him, you know, because it's genuine and he knows Rourke doesn't, you know, BS. And that kind of thing. But those moments, is like that's when you latch on to what's really genuine and you go home and you reflect and you think about like what that means and like why does it mean so much to me? But he doesn't really think. He doesn't want to think and he tries to cover up. And so he's a mixed case. But I do think that, so we had an intern at ARI who was asked, because we interviewed them sometimes, you know, and who is your favorite character in Ayn Rand's literature? Peter Keating. What? But what she said, though, is, I think, goes to your point. She said, I found him the most relatable. Now, I didn't, but I kind of get that. I think a lot of people, if they thought about that, maybe less so objectivist, but nonetheless, I think a lot of people, they thought about that, yeah, this kind of looks like what my life looks like, or something like that. Am I just climbing the ladder, trying to maneuver around, and have I not really thought about what I'm doing, and things like that? Yeah. So I think on the one hand, he has a sympathetic aspect to him, and it's his better self when he's more honest and he's more genuine with himself. And there's a tragic element to him. But there's also, for him at least, there's so much that he does it's a real... He doesn't want to think about things. He's not Jim Taggart, you know, level. But, yeah, somebody else had a microphone.
Yes. Can you talk about the role that patience plays in idealism?
Wait a little bit. No. Well, so patience, I think, is... let me just get... So this is off the cuff. So everything's off the cuff here. You have to be careful with patience. Like on the one hand, Yeah, I mean, you got to have some patience. I mean, you can't expect everything, you know, comes to your door, right? So there, some things are longer term kinds of achievements, longer term investments. Sometimes it takes time to get things to happen. Sometimes if it's a relationship, sometimes you have to spend time to wait for someone to come around and learn on their own. And is Rourke patient with Dominique? Yeah. I mean, I guess you could put it that way. I mean, he has to wait. He can't like, come on, Dom, you know, it ain't that bad, right? He doesn't really try to convince her. He just shows through his own life. But patience, I think, can often be, not disguised is not the right word, mistaken for it. You can take it too far. It's like, I'm just being patient. And sometimes, no, you're just putting off things that one ought to do, one should be engaging more. It's like waiting 15 years for a promotion. Pretty soon, they'll recognize, no, that's not, sure, you have long-range goals, and patience is required in various kinds of ways, but, you know, that one has to be a little cautious with, am I just being patient in the right perspective, I guess. In its relation to idealism, I don't know that I have much to say about that. That, I mean, long-range goals take time, and not everything comes at once, but you have to be careful that what one is doing is not perpetually waiting and waiting, and then you have cancer. And it's sort of like you have to demand a lot of how you prioritize your time and use your time. And yeah, I don't know if that goes to what you were looking for, but.
Yeah, but yeah, pretty much. I also had another question. What about the difference between idealism in your personal life and yearning to live in an ideal society, as the comparing the two?
Huh. I don't think about living in an ideal society. Just from my own head, I don't think about that. I do what I can to kind of promote the kind of ideas and try to talk to people and educate people about the kinds of things that they should want. But it's not in my control. Lots of stuff is in my control, and that's not really one of them. It depends fundamentally on other people's understanding, other people's, this is my stoic stuff coming out again, other people's understanding, other people's choices. I don't have control of that. What I have control over, though, is what I do with my own time, with my own life, my mind, my character, and to be committed to the best of what I can for myself. So I don't really think about that. What I do think about is, am I settling? And that goes just across the board. It can be things in job, it's relationships, it's even little things. The things that you, I don't know, it's your apartment or something like that. I mean, it's just like, when you watch the way somebody like Rourke or Kira, I mean, Kira is a great, Kira Argunova, in We the Living is just, she just doesn't settle for anything less. And she really means that. And it's not like an act, and it's, you know. But I think there's a lot of settling that you have to kind of, when you kind of getting through life and managing its difficulties and stuff, sometimes you settle just because, like, I can't handle it all now. And, like, I can't deal with that and that and that at the same time. It's like, I need to get through, you know. And you can do that a lot. And sometimes you look back and say, God, I've been doing that for how long? What am I doing? You know, and then I think, am I an idealist? You see what I mean? And it's like, well, wait a second, hold on. You know, it's like, yeah, I hold those values. I think it's impossible. But when you think of really holding your values, it's, are you holding them as a kind of a private interior ideal? Or are you actively engaged in working for them? And there's a way in which if all you're doing is you have Winans Art Gallery, if that's what your ideals are, it's hard to say whether you're an idealist. And I, you know, because there is a real action component, I think. But does somebody have a question? Because I was going to say something about Dominique, but go ahead.
Okay. In relation to what's the moral and the possible. I remember the first time I read The Fountainhead, the first thought that came to my mind was, how did she know that? You know, like the details, and that's a great connection between what's ideal and what's possible, because she concretized so many examples. Like, she never worked in a corporate environment. How can she know all the details? And I would like to hear from you how thinking in principle in relation to that, about being selfish or selfless, you know, and how can she concretize all these elements as if she lived all these scenarios?
Well, I think one thing is, so when it comes to Howard Rourke's psychology, she said the evidence is introspective for me. You only really know your own consciousness in that regard, and it's like my data for that was my own introspection about how I feel about my career and how I feel about my work. And she was very observant. I mean, if you think about Rourke, he observes the principle behind the dean. You know, it's something he observes, a phenomena that he doesn't get. He files it in the back, and he starts to observe more and more examples of these kinds of things, and he sees it. I mean, so the example with Peter Keating was, someone Rand used to work with at, I think, the RKO Studios, I think it was. And she had said something like, you guys probably know the story, right? Yeah. If nobody had a car, I wouldn't want one. If other people have a car, I want one. If they get two, I want two. And it's like, and Rand is just like, what? This is how you approach life? It's like, it's entirely secondhand. You observe what other people go after. Then I want that. And it's like, where is your you? Where is your, don't you have things that you think about independently and want? And it got her on the, and her working title for this was Secondhand Lives. And it was on that. And I think it was the editor who suggested that. That tends to focus a bit, maybe too much on the negative when Rourke's your character. But so she changed the title eventually. But did you have a question?
Yeah, I'm sorry for my English, but I'll try to formulate. I was wondering if it is one's choice to follow the morality, or it's just, in my experience, I have noticed two sorts of people. One sort has strong character, and the other, they're just like doormat, they can't choose anything. And like Keating, for example. And for example, elsewhere to he, in my view, he has a strong character, and if he wanted, he could be a moral idealist in objectivism. And so I just don't know if it's possible to choose your moral ideal if you haven't got a strong character. For example, how as Keating, he couldn't do anything, in my view, or not.
Okay, so I guess that's a good question. What I would say is, how does one develop a strong character? So I don't think that, Rand doesn't think that. There are people with strong characters, and then there are other people that don't. I think her view is that, and this goes to her view about free will, is that it's always open to you in any given situation all throughout your life. This is an ongoing thing. To choose to, you know, engage your mind, to think about what you're doing, to stop. What does John Locke say? Stop, look around, assess what's going on, form a view about it. And that is something that's constantly open to you. And I think the reason why he doesn't have, like Keating doesn't have a strong character, he doesn't do that. So he never really forms the convictions that are really a part of him. Because, like, yeah, I know that's true. And I know this is really important. And I've validated it. In fact, I understand it. And it becomes a real part of his character. And so I guess what I would say is I don't take the strength or weakness of a character to be innate, but it's built. And it's self-built. I think somebody's telling me to wrap up for time. So sorry, but thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.